From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Korea was divided in 1945 into a communist north under Soviet protection and an authoritarian dictatorship in the south. Would the Americans protect it? A fateful ambiguity hung over that question. Secretary of State Dean Acheson omitted South Korea in a speech outlining the U.S. security perimeter in Asia. That was in January 1950. In June, North Korea invaded the South, driving South Korean and U.S. troops down the peninsula until resistance stiffened around the port of Pusan. Meanwhile, General Douglas MacArthur, the Allied commander, landed forces behind the North Korean lines in Incheon, captured Seoul, and moved north of the border in hot pursuit of the North Korean army, dismissing concerns that his advance through the north might provoke China to join the war. MacArthur was nearing the Yalu River, the border with China, when 300,000 Chinese attacked, driving U.S. forces back down the peninsula out of North Korea. A war of stalemate ensued until a truce ended hostilities in July 1953. Today, unfinished business from that war once again haunts the region. Tonight, we're talking with Korean War veterans who were there, listening, learning, and trying to understand what history can teach us today about Korea's crisis. Do you have a Korean War veteran in your family? What stories have they shared with you about fighting in the forgotten war? And how does that inform your understanding of America, Korea, and the world then and now? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Arlington, Virginia, is Colonel Sherman Pratt. He was in the 23rd Infantry Regiment of the 2nd Infantry Division of the U.S. Army in Korea. Colonel Pratt, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be here if you think I can help.
And with us as well is Sergeant Ray Donnelly, who is also joining us from Arlington. He was in the 5th Regimental Combat Team of the 24th Division of the U.S. Army in Korea. Sergeant Donnelly, again, it's a privilege to have you on the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure, sir.
Sergeant Donnelly, let's start with you. We're trying to give our listeners the face of war here. Tell us about your war, your Korean War, your experience of combat.
Well, in 1951, I headed for Korea from Fort Devens, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And it was in June we had completed our training at Fort Devens and shipped out for Korea. I didn't even know where it was. I mean, maps and whatnot they were working with, it just showed a little thing there north of Japan, and of course I went to the West Coast and spent 14 days on a boat going over to the Far East and ended up with the 5th Regimental Combat Team in Korea. Now, they refer to that as the pipeline. In other words, you go into the pipeline where you transferred from one unit to the next unit to the next unit. And I was told when I got there, it took a month to get from Fort Devens to reporting to the 5th Regimental Combat Team on the front lines there in Korea. I was told that if for every month that I would be with a frontline outfit, I would get 4 points.
Mm-hmm.
If you're back further, you get 3 points, and back further, 2 points. When you accumulated 40 points, then you were put on a rotation roster and sent home.
40 points, that's a long...
It was 10 months.
Yeah.
And it takes a month to get back to Fort Devens. So you're gone. I was gone just a year. I went over, took a month to get there, 10 months with a frontline outfit, and got my 4 points per month, got my 40 points, and rotated home. It was from June of 51 to June of 52. Mm-hmm. And and talking about the war itself, I think what I remember most, and Colonel Pratt will, I'm sure, back me up, was the cold. It was unbelievably cold over there, as a result, I still have hands that are a little crooked from being frostbitten so many times, and they were operated on 11 times to for make small corrections in them. So the cold, I think I would when people say, what do you think about career is the cold?
We remember the phrase, when I was a little boy, the frozen chosen. What was that phrase about?
That was a chosen reservoir. Mm-hmm. That's one of the battles that was fought there, and I'm sure Colonel Pratt would be far more eloquent explaining that, because that part of the activity, because he was more familiar with that side of it on that side of the peninsula. But the Frozen Chosen is the Chosen Reservoir.
Mm.
And that's where the 1st Marine Division was up in there, and they have organizations, the Chosen Few, that are referred to as those that survive that and meet regularly once a year. That's a veterans organization by itself.
Did your group, Sergeant Donnelly, fight against the North Koreans as well as the Chinese? And what was that like? I mean, we've heard of these human wave attacks from the Chinese.
Well, that's true. They came at you in waves, and an awful lot of them. With a lot of noise, they're blowing bugles and making an awful lot of noise coming at you. It wasn't a quiet war, if you would, but. And we had searchlights there. We used to bounce the searchlights off the clouds and light up the front line over there, which was a bit unusual. I mean, I don't know what they used the searchlights for, probably in other wars. That was the only one I was in. I was in World War II. I was in the Marines, but I didn't go overseas.
Mm.
But the searchlights would bounce off keep the front lines lit up. They would come at our lines, and we would move back or move forward or stay in a position. And it didn't move much. The line didn't move much in those months because evidenced by the fact that we started out at the 38th parallel and we're back at the 38th parallel.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as how much ground did we gain, not that much.
Mm. Colonel Pratt, how about you? Tell us, give us a flavor of your war in Korea.
Well, I was on duty with a Reserve National Guard headquarters down in Little Rock, Arkansas, and shortly after the war started over there, they started landing the divisions from Japan and Okinawa into Korea, and then they started sending in, but they were under strength mostly, and they were having battle casualties, so there was a desperate need for more bodies over there. So they reached out and grabbed about anybody they could find here in the States, and I was one of a number of people that were quickly sent over there as replacements. I had a lot of experience in World War II in infantry duty. I was had a battlefield commission over in France toward the end of the war, and I had fought with the 3rd Division, which had been going all through Italy and Sicily and North Africa and Italy and the southern France and so on. So I had a lot of combat experience. I thought perhaps for that reason I wouldn't have to go to Korea.
Mm.
But on the contrary, I was one of the first people they picked.
Mm.
So I joined the 2nd Division, who had come in from Fort Lewis, Washington, down on the Pusan perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenge there was to hang on and try to avoid being pushed right back into the sea. And it was nip and tuck because most of the units there were far under strength, and they were holding out a far wider front than they really they should have been called upon to do. But the time came, along about the time the Incheon landings that you referred to a moment ago in your opening statement, we broke out of the Pusan perimeter. Very quickly, the North Korean army just disappeared. They just sort of disappeared into the woods and in the villages. And it was a problem for the next several weeks as we rushed up to the 38th parallel. And then MacArthur finally got permission to cross the 38th parallel, and we continued on up near the Manchurian border, trying to find the North Koreans. But as I say, they mostly just evaporated. And then about in November of 50, we were, MacArthur finally got permission to continue the advance on up to the Manchurian border. At that point, Washington here, this is all in the history books and well documented, but Washington was saying to MacArthur, but the Chinese say they're going to intervene if you push any closer to their border. And MacArthur and his people said, oh, don't believe that. That's so much propaganda. They're a paper tiger. They're not going to come into this war. Well, right after Thanksgiving, we got orders to resume the advance, and we saddled up and started to attack, I guess it was along about November the 25th. And during the night, as we were moving up to resume the advance, the Chinese suddenly were all over us by the hundreds of thousands. And we started fighting for the next several days. Finally, it was decided by the high command that you better get the 8th Army out of North Korea in a hurry, or they're going to be surrounded and cut off and annihilated. So the command made the decision to leave one unit behind, almost sacrificially, to fight a rearguard action to hold the Chinese off long enough so that the rest of the 8th Army could escape. Now, this is not the Chosin people over on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
They were a separate command divided by a ring of mountains up and down the Korean backbone of the peninsula. But this division that was left behind was my 2nd Infantry Division. And we fought a rearguard action. We were the last out. Everybody else had gotten out before we were permitted to start our withdrawal. But by that time, we had been mostly cut off also. And as a result of that, we succeeded in our mission because the rest of the Army got out pretty much intact.
What sort of casualties did you experience?
The 8th Army got out pretty much intact. The 2nd Division, we were so badly mauled, that finally when we did start withdrawing and pull back down around 38th parallel, we were declared combat ineffective. So because we had over 50% casualties. Most of the missing in action from the Korean War today, when you start talking about battlefield casualties, in the Korean War, we had around 33,000 killed and almost 100,000 or more wounded. And then another figure that enters into it is your missing in action. Because those people are sort of lumped with the KIAs because they're not around today.
Right.
Sergeant, nobody really knows where they are.
Sure.
Well, most of the 8,000 missing in action are from my 2nd Division in that as a result of that rear guard action.
Now, Sergeant Donnelly, you know something about people missing in action. Apparently you were one of a group that left from Camp Devens and the only one to return. What was...
18 of us left Fort Devens for Korea. And, I was the only one to come back alive. The rest of them were killed over there. I will share, and one of the winners, his name was Eddie Bunker. And Eddie comes from Cranberry Isle, Maine. And Eddie was killed on October the 8th over there in 51. And when they brought his body back to Bar Harbor, Maine, and took it out to the island in a boat, when his father saw the casket, his father died of a heart attack.
Oh.
So they buried them side by side on the island. I've been to the gravesite several times. And he left 4 sisters up there. And today, the loss is deeply felt. And this is 50 years later, and it's an enormous impact on the island and on the people. There aren't that many people on the island. But this is one of the lingering sad stories about the Korean War and the impact it had on so many families. So I miss Eddie. I think of almost every day as I do the others.
Well, I'm sure you do. Sergeant Donnelly, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And thank you for your service, too. We're talking about the Korean War this hour at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Korean War, a distant, not so distant mirror for the crises of today. We read that just today, in fact, the North Koreans have threatened to break out of the armistice that ended the Korean War. So Korea and the Korean War live. We're asking if you have memories of the Korean War, if your parents did, if your loved ones did. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm sorry. Calling us now is Marilyn from Newton, Massachusetts. Marilyn, thank you so much for calling. Excuse me.
Thank you. Thank you for this program. Actually, I don't barely remember the Korean War. I was too young. But a few years ago, I went for the first time to Castle Island in Boston, and walking around the island, the outermost tip, with a friend of mine from South Boston, he pointed to a statue there surrounded by a little garden and a plaque with the names of, I don't know, 25, 30 young men, all under 21, who were killed in the war. And I tell you, I've gone back time and again ever since to see that statue, and I have never seen a memorial that affected me ever the way this one does. This man explained it to me. It's a young Korean soldier, and he's leaning over, and he has a rifle and a knapsack on his back. He's hunched over against the cold, and his pants are stuffed into those tall lace boots. And this father, whose son's name was on the plaque, explained to me that those boots, that the Army stopped issuing boots like that after Korea because the laces froze and the men couldn't get the boots off and they got gangrene or they lost their legs. But what strikes me most about that statue, and it's why I go back often to take to see it, is the look on the face. I don't know who did the statue. It's incredible, but he's looking inward, and he looks exhausted and confused and maybe betrayed. I may be reading the last into it. I don't know. But that statue, more than anything I've ever seen as a memorial, I have been thinking about it a lot as we talk about going into war. I never thought that we would ever, ever be at this again. And that's all I really wanted to say.
Well, thank you for calling, Marilyn. Colonel Sherman Pratt, a moving picture of that statue from Maryland. But the notion of being betrayed, hard word, but in fact, the Army was not very well served. Your equipment was not up to par, was it?
I don't think we've ever gone into a war in modern times more ill-prepared than we went into the Korean War. Nowadays, with the force buildup over there in the Middle East, we're taking months to build that force up. The troops are going in there trained. They have good equipment. They're prepared emotionally and psychologically, or to the maximum extent they can be. But most people do not realize that when the Korean War broke out, we didn't have time to do all that. Unless the North Koreans were going to be stopped before they got to Busan in the southeast corner of the country, troops had to be thrown in there almost overnight. So they picked up the occupation troops from Japan, 24th and 25th Divisions, and the 7th Division and the 1st Marine Division from Okinawa, and they just threw them in there almost overnight. They were not prepared. They didn't have good equipment. They didn't have training because they had been in garrison duty in Japan, police duty, you might say. They had not had field exercises. They were totally untrained. Their equipment was mostly rotten and rusty, old stuff that they had salvaged from the islands of the Pacific in World War II. Is one of the most shameful periods of American history when you stop to consider how ill prepared were the troops that were thrown into Korea almost overnight, and yet they had to try to hang on with their fingernails to try to keep from being pushed back into the ocean, because if the North Koreans had succeeded in pushing them out, well then relanding in Korea would have been politically and militarily impractical.
It would never have happened.
We read that the bazooka shells would bounce off the tanks,
exactly.
For example. Yeah, yeah. Joining us now on the line from Atlanta is General Draymond Davis. He was Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Marine Corps Commanding Officer, 1st Battalion, 7th Marine, 1st Marine Division. He was awarded the Medal of Honor for service in Korea in 1950. General Davis, welcome to our program and thank you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, we've been hearing about the big picture and the small picture. Tell us, General Davis, if you would, how, under what circumstances did you win the Medal of Honor in Korea?
Well, I'd like to reinforce the idea of our readiness. When the war started, my regiment did not exist. It had been cut out after World War II. And we formed it by joining some forces. We had a battalion afloat in the Mediterranean that joined us in Japan. But my duty was, on 5 days, to form a new battalion, get it on a ship, and go to war.
Five days.
Luckily, our supplies came in. We commandeered the trucks and went around Camp Pendleton, California. In 4 hours, I was able to round up 800 Marines. Now, this was because President Truman had called up the reserve. That was important. And the reserves had been shipped out there and scattered about, and they all joined. And in 5 days, we were on a ship going to war. We worked all the way across the ocean. We were in reserve at the Incheon landing. After we had recaptured this capital city of Seoul, we were sent around to the other coast and up into the mountains to clear up the rest of North Korea so that it would be unified as a democracy. And it was at that time, after Thanksgiving, when the weather turned, I went for a swim in the river on November the 10th to celebrate the Marine Corps birthday. 3 days later, the temperature dropped to 16 below zero.
Mm.
And from then on, we were in that kind of weather up around the chosen reservoir where our 1st Marine Division had been assigned. And at the Chinese onfall came, we were outnumbered something like 10 to 1. Fortunately, they were not prepared for the weather. We had our division was divided up on two sides of a mountain pass, and we had a rifle company in the mountain pass protecting it, and it had been under attack by a regiment of Chinese for 3 days. It was about to be lost. Several efforts had been made to go in that direction. All failed. And I was told to come up with a plan to go and rescue the company and over the pass. I'd been over that little narrow road. It was a little narrow 12-foot road chiseled out of a granite cliff, easily defended by the Chinese. So I told the commander I would fight my way out through the Chinese encirclement, go around through the mountains, rescue the company, and over the pass. He said, plan approved, get going. Took the rest of the day to fight our way out. Just before dark, we headed out through the deep snow, 40 below zero in the valley. My weather prophet, brother-in-law, said it must have been 75 below the wind chill where we were. Food frozen, water frozen, eating snow, ice over the faces, and so forth. And 3 days and three nights, this battalion of mine, the 1st Battalion, 7th Regiment, continued. We had a few skirmishes. We found three different places where the Chinese were defending a hill, and they had all frozen to death.
Oh, they had frozen to death just sitting there waiting.
Yeah, they had dug in their little holes. They were all there. And I had an intelligence sergeant, a big husky fellow, who went around pulling some of them out of the holes and looked at their eyes to see if there was any life left in them. And there were three units like that, frozen to death, tennis shoes and no socks. That shows what the communists think of their people when they'll send Chinese from South China into that weather with no preparation at all. They had no artillery support. No clothing, no food. And so we were able to get the job done, as I say, 3 days, three nights. Not one complaint, not one fallback from my troops, because they were going to rescue other Marines, and that stuck with me, one for all for one.
Mm.
And we got the job done. They got the job done, and I was awarded the Medal of Honor.
Mm. And of course, it was really you and your whole outfit that did it and deserved it for what you did.
Yeah, and it was very successful. We got the division back together. They fought their way to the coast. We had 90,000 civilians go with us. The Chinese had destroyed their villages. We had almost 100,000 Allied troops, including the South Koreans. And we all got out of there because some people said because of my battalion success in getting the division back together.
Well, we're glad to hear it happened. Let's take a call. Dean is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello.
Hi. How are you this evening?
Well, fine, thank you.
I'm calling because I find this topic very interesting. My uncle, my father's brother, was a Korean War medic. He was in the medical corps, and he was killed during the war while he went out to try to save a wounded soldier, and he was killed by enemy fire. And the thing that was interesting about his life was he was a Greek-American immigrant, and he came to the U.S. while he was a teenager, and he started learning English, and then he just became really interested in writing, and he wrote a lot of essays and poems, some of which he wrote while he was in Korea. And these poems were kind of hanging around in our family archives, basically people's spare rooms and stuff. And then as the 50th year anniversary of his death was coming closer, I thought it would be a really good idea to publish this. I'm actually putting them together planning to publish them sometime this spring.
Do you have a short stanza you could read for us?
I do.
This is a poem he wrote in Korea.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yes. And actually, what I was just hearing about the general who was talking about his experience, you know, there's a lot of like very gripping moments during that time and just a lot of difficulty.
Sure.
But this kind of shows some of the difficulty of that period. It's called My Foxhole.
Mm-hmm.
On a high, high mount in Korea, wild lads, we stopped for a night under enemy fire, and I took my trenching tool to build my foxhole under enemy fire. There were many of our heroes wounded in action and on hand to call me for treatment. Doc, there. Doc, here. Medic, there. And medic, here. The voices were coming to my ears. It was a bloody night for memories of centuries. And poor me, I built my foxhole, but had no time to sleep in it.
Ah, Dean, thank you. We'll get a reaction from that in a minute. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. Colonel Pratt, would you like to chime in here about the foxhole?
Does he know what unit that the fellow was with, that his uncle was with?
Yes, he was in Company B, I guess it's the Baker Company, in the 9th Infantry Regiment of the 2nd Division.
Yes, that was my division.
Really?
I was in the 23rd Regiment.
Oh.
9th. Okay. Do you know about what time he was there?
Yes, he was killed. Let's see. He was killed in 51. So he was really, you know, he was one of the first ones. He graduated.
Was he over there a little earlier than that?
The
9th Regiment and the 38th Regiment are the two regiments that were trying to pull back. The division was the last unit to pull out of North Korea when the Chinese intervened. Two regiments started out. They started on the road to the south. One of them was the 9th Regiment. But in a little narrow valley on a winding road, primitive road, and the Chinese were able to cut the road in front of them and bottle them up, and then proceeded to just chop them to pieces from the hills on both sides. It was a real slaughterhouse. S.L.A. Marshall, the historian, has written about it, and he calls it the river in the gauntlet. But I'm just pointing out the reason I mention it. I was with the 23rd Regiment, and we were behind them, and we had our troubles getting out also, but not nearly as much as the 9th and the 38th Regiment. Our regimental commander took us out a road to the west instead of south, so we were able to escape the fate of the 9th Regiment. But your uncle, with the 9th Regiment, went through some of the toughest fighting in the whole Korean War.
Mm.
Just gruesome, ghastly experience.
And the emphasis on the foxhole, the Korean War, a good deal of it was fought with bayonets and hand-to-hand combat, wasn't it?
There was a lot of hand-to-hand combat. We had a lot of hand-to-hand combat as we were pulling out. The morning that we were going to withdraw, all of a sudden, but just before daylight, we were hit by some. We were up on a mountain top on a guarding a road that was the escape route for the whole Eighth Army, and our mission was to hold that until the Eighth Army, until we got word that the rest of the Eighth Army had withdrawn, and we did that, and we were waiting for permission for us to withdraw, but just before daylight. We got hit by maybe 1,000 Chinese who came out of the darkness with their little tennis shoes on and so forth. As General Davis just mentioned, the Chinese had their problems too because they weren't equipped for this extreme cold, but they did have a sort of a quilted uniform that was I think in some respects maybe warmer than our, but they had tennis shoes which was subjected to, I guess, the frozen feet. They must have had an awful lot of the Chinese soldiers that wound up the war with frozen feet as a result of that. But in this fighting on the top of the mountain, it was strictly a hand-to-hand in the darkness, close combat. Yeah. An answer to your question.
General Davis, did the...
The caller is calling in there. I didn't want to monopolize this, but he can be very proud, I think, of his uncle for having been participated in some of the toughest, most ghastly part of the war.
Well, thank you for reminding us of that. General Davis, a police action, Harry Truman called it. Tough thing to call a war, isn't it?
Yes, it was not called a war until a couple of years ago when the Congress finally changed it to a war. But I think that was political, I think.
Oh, yeah, that's always been sensitive with a Korean War veteran when they refer to the fighting over there as a police action.
Yeah, well, that was
the
only way.
A Korean War veteran is, of course, likely to say, police my butt. This is a full-scale war.
Well, I think that's the only way Harry Truman could get it done legally without going to Congress and having a declaration of war. And he had to do it overnight. So I think that was a expeditious way for the president to get it going.
We're talking about the Korean War, a very resonant war today. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're looking at the not-so-distant mirror of the Korean War this hour. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to two Korean War veterans and three Korean War veterans, and now we're talking to James Lee. He's a translator and interrogator for the G2, 1st U.S. Marine Division of the U.S. Marine Corps. He retired in 1994 after 41 years of service with the U.S. Department of Defense. Mr. Lee, thank you for joining us.
Hi, how are you? I'll be happy to join you.
Well, it's very important for Americans to understand what the Korean War was like for the South Korean people. We see these statistics, 4 million casualties. You were in Seoul. You were a student at the university. Give us your experience of what this frightful war was like for the Korean people.
Before the North Koreans invaded South Korea on 25th of June, 1950, on Sunday morning, we've been hearing over radio the South Korean government telling the people that, we'll march to the north, we'll have a lunch in Pyongyang, in North Korean capital, and then have dinner at Sinju, which is border town up on Yalu River. So we believed in the ROK, South Korean government, talk that sooner or later we unify, take over North Korean communist North Korea and then unify the country.
Mm-hmm.
Then one Sunday morning, I went to get a barbershop, get a haircut in the barbershop in my neighborhood. And I was getting my haircut, listening to radio, and they talk about the North Koreans invade the South. I heard it. It was a big surprise for me to hear that over radio. Mm-hmm. And then the same afternoon, I was asked to go out to our campus, which is located north of city, capital city of Seoul, to guard our lab. I was junior in chemical engineering department of Seoul National University, which is located outskirts of Seoul, northern outskirts of Seoul. We're watching the lab. The same night, we had a bunch of South Korean soldiers retreating from the front, and they saw us with sticks, broomsticks, guarding our lab. They asked us, "What are you guys doing?" So we said, "We are guarding our chemical lab." And they say, "You're out of your mind. North Koreans are coming with tanks. There's no way we can stop them. You better just throw away your sticks and then join us and go back to Seoul." So we came back to Seoul, and then I went home. And then I really had to persuade my mother to go cross the river. The only bridge existed in Seoul to go across the river, Han River. And then finally she gave in, and then I took my mother and then two younger brothers and went across the river over the only existing bridge.
And my
father was down south and then in a business trip. So that same night, early in the morning actually, the South Korean engineers blew up the bridge. Majority of the people in Seoul had no choice to escape from communist takeover.
Mm.
And from there, I joined the rest of the refugees and walked all the way to Busan. Mm. So we left Ujongbu, or rather I take it back, to Yongdongpo, south of Seoul, south of the bridge, on the 27th of June, and arrived in Busan in early August.
Oh, walking all that time.
Walking all the way.
And through scenes of devastation. I mean, the war was, its effect on the Korean people was just profound, wasn't it?
Right.
The destruction.
Really, the people are just running away from their homes.
Mm.
And then the North Koreans came all the way down to Nakdong River, the last little land that South Korea possessed. There was Nakdong, what we call the Nakdong River Pyramid. Actually, that is the final position that U.S. 1st Marine Division and I think the 24th Division and a couple of the U.S. Army divisions defended that particular pyramid. And we thought that North Koreans are about to take over South Korea through military means. But fortunately, we defended.
Ah, indeed.
And then I went to Ministry of Education in Busan, and then the Minister of Education, who ran away from Seoul, had some students around him, gathered around, and then he asked us to go out and help U.S. forces just arriving.
And that's how you got into the translating business.
That's right. So I was the first one, the Korean went to 1st Marine Brigade, just landed at Busan.
And you became the translator. We have a lot of callers who want to join us here, James Lee. Anne is calling from Newton, Mass. Hello.
Yes, here I am.
Yes, Anne. Your question?
Well, I didn't have a question. I just wanted to relate what the experience was for the families who were left behind.
Yes.
And my husband was a surgeon in an evacuation unit and then at a prisoner of war camp for the North Koreans. So I was left with two very little babies. And my frustration beyond the war and all the horror of that was the people who were here. There was very little in the newspaper. I mean, it was not well covered as I remember it. Because I remember the first letter to the editor I ever wrote was to the Boston Globe because I had to sort of look through the paper to find some news about what was happening. And you also had no support system because I knew nobody whose husband was in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
It was a draftees. My husband would have been drafted because there was a doctor draft, but he had enlisted. And it was an experience that has impacted our family since. because it was the most horrible year of my life. It was 2 years, but 1 year in Korea, and 1 year with the children, you know, with no father.
And you didn't know from day to day where he was, what was happening to him?
No, I knew he was in an evacuation hospital, but he wasn't that far from the front. Also, in a prisoner of war camp, that was a difficult situation, too.
Mm-hmm.
He used to have to taste the food in front of the entire camp every day.
These were North Korean prisoners who were feared to be being poisoned. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. General Davis, any response to that? The home front in a war like this?
Yes, that was exactly the picture. In fact, I had a daughter born while I was in the middle of my campaign at Chosin Reservoir, and my wife had read in the paper where all the Marines were lost, so she thought that we were lost almost the same day our daughter was born. So it was a very difficult situation.
Oh, God, yeah. Colonel Pratt, do you have a memory of a similar memory, too?
I think the lady pointed out well. The Korean people suffered indescribably as a result of the war. Most of the war just wiped out their villages through refugees. It's hard to overemphasize or over-describe the hardships that the Korean people endured as a result of the Korean War.
Yeah, and we can understand quite well why they want to avoid anything like that today. Thank you so much for your call. And David is calling from Dover, Massachusetts. Hello, David.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
Well, just fine. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I don't know. I listen to the program every night, and I just felt like calling. My father was in the Korean War, and, you know, I was listening to the program. And he passed away about 10 years ago, and he was, I don't know if your experts would know, but he was in he was Company F of 223 Infantry. And he left me with some mementos, and one of the things was this prayer book. And I remember I opened it up when he had passed away, and this letter fell out. You know, from someone, a wife of someone that had died under his command, mm-hmm. basically imploring him to, you know, try to search and search and search and search for, you know, this woman's husband. And I just thought it was interesting because he never talked about this stuff. And my experience was that a lot of the veterans from the Korean War just didn't really talk a lot about what happened to them. And a lot of us are left to try to sort of figure out what.
Why don't you think he talked about it? Was there the feeling that they didn't, that it wasn't a clear victory, or that it was a state? What was the reason he didn't talk?
I remember he was, I remember because I grew up in, you know, the child of the 60s, and I remember, you know, him sort of looking at the Vietnam era, sort of, you know, and I can't remember a specific comment, but it was somewhat like, you know, that he had been in the Korean War and, you know, that they just didn't talk about it. And he was sort of surprised that with the Vietnam conflict at how vocal the country was about it.
That's very interesting, David. General Davis, was there a kind of, you know, people just didn't talk about serving in Korea? Was there? Does that jive with your own experience, that it was sort of a forgotten war almost from the start?
No, I thought when President Truman called up the reserve, we had the basis for filling out our units. And fortunately, many of those had World War II experience. One reason my battalion succeeded was because I had many officers, non-commissioned officers, who had been in World War II. So I don't know of anything going on in the country like it is today or like it was for Vietnam.
You know, in looking back on the war, some people say that you people prevented World War III. That you essentially suffered to preserve deterrence, that the Soviet Union learned that there were limits to what the West would accept, and that essentially kept the peace. And then there are other people, other historians of the Korean War, who say that you all did so well fighting on the Asian mainland and with limited equipment that you bequeathed to the army and to the civilians the notion that we could fight successfully on the Asian mainland, and that bequeathed Vietnam. What do you say about that, Colonel Pratt?
Well, to back step for a moment, I think that a lot of the veterans of the Korean War have long been somewhat reluctant to talk about it. For number one, it's a chapter in their life which is not particularly very pleasant. And also there's a feeling, I don't think it's any secret, that the American people did not support the Korean and Vietnamese wars. It's not popular here on the home front. Mm-hmm. So when we came home from the war, the Korean War, there were no great parades and everything like there was in New York following the Gulf War 10 years ago, or even World War II. It was almost as though the American people were ashamed of those wars and wanted to sweep them under the rug and forget about them. Well, in that sort of an atmosphere or climate, well, then I think the veteran of the war is not likely to come back here and start sounding off about his part in a war which is very unpopular here on the home front. I think that contributed to it to a very large extent.
And, of course, the war was one of the reasons they said about Harry Truman in 1952 he couldn't be elected dog catcher in Independence, Missouri.
Yeah, I guess so.
But what about this notion of what you people achieved? Keeping the peace, but on the other hand, perhaps giving the Americans the wrong idea about fighting on the Asian mainland.
Well, that's a difficult, there's a lot of different sides to that question. I feel rather comfortable about the Korean War overall. I think that, you know, I think we won it. We accomplished our mission of the United Nations gave us to throw the aggressor out of South Korea, and we accomplished that. We didn't unify the whole country. That would have been a nice extra if we could have done it, but the Chinese prevented that. But if you go back to South Korea today and look at that country and compare it with the communist North, it should make a veteran or any American feel rather proud that we had a hand in preserving democracy and freedom in South Korea. South Korea is one of the most prosperous and vital countries in the world, with one of the highest standards of living. They almost have eliminated illiteracy altogether in that country. It's when you compare it to the basket case of the North Korea, and you think that we had a hand in creating, helping to create, and encourage South Korea, I think the veteran can feel very proud of the fact that he had a hand in all this.
James Lee, is there gratitude toward the American veteran still in South Korea?
Yes, definitely. Majority of Koreans, especially after the Armistice Day, really appreciate what the United States did. Also, what we had was United Nations Command, which was established in accordance with UN Security Council Resolution 7/50, and had the U.S. government appointing General MacArthur and, running the command with 16 nations, troops participating in the war, but without the U.S. participation help early on.
Indeed it did.
Korea could have been taken, South Korea could have been, pretty well taken over by the North Koreans.
James Lee, thank you.
The objective.
Thank you very much. General Davis, thank you for joining us. And Colonel Sherman Pratt, thank you for joining us. And thank you all for your service to the country. You can continue the conversation on our website. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Jack Beatty, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.